and my brethren and sisters in a place called Germany. Yeah. Burn, baby, burn. Returns next week, same place, same time, right here. Flag burning time. 3 minutes in front of 5 o'clock. Brand new morning show with Michael G at 6 o'clock, right into 8 o'clock. Amy Goodman, Democracy Now More Than Ever. Juan Gonzalez, don't miss it. See ya. The station WBAI 99.5 FM New York, WBAI.RG, and it's approaching 60 seconds in front of 5 o'clock. Stay tuned.
What's going on with the weather forecasting? What's the National Weather Service really like? What's happened to our weather satellites? Tune in to Ken Gale's Ecologic with meteorologist Tom Weisfeller and author Catherine Miles to find out. Tuesday, April 28th at 8 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
Next on What's the Frequency, Kenneth?
Strange days befall us. Strange days have dragged us down.
You look across the country, the deck is still stacked in favor of those already at the top. And there's something wrong with that. There's something wrong when CEOs make 300 times more than the typical worker.
I admit that as a journalist who spent decades covering politics, I'm really puzzled. Puzzled by, among other things, why I'm hearing so many pundits say that Hillary Clinton needs to say why she's running for president. Contrary, I think Scott Walker, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and Jeb Bush not so much. They need to tell us why they're running for president. And in some cases, they have.
Yeah! I believe the country's living a historic moment. It's transitioning into this post-industrial era, an era of extraordinary opportunity. Our ideas are not allowing our nation to fulfill its potential in this new century. I believe I have the ideas for the country. I believe I have the vision for the country. I believe I'm positioned to help lead this country to this new American century. I think the 21st century is going to be better than the 20th century. But there's some things we're going to have to do to make that happen.
Really? You think she needs to give a speech about why she's running for president? Hillary Clinton was first lady for 8 years, took the first run on improving health care coverage against incredible political headwinds, was a U.S. senator who, by all accounts, gets an A for working well with others, Republican and Democratic, a Secretary of State for the president who beat her in the primaries. And you think she needs to explain why she wants to be president? I don't think so. What's more interesting to me is that in explaining herself now on the campaign trail, she's channeling Elizabeth Warren, including student debt and student loans.
I just want to tell you a little bit about why I'm here today. Some pretty tough economic times. And our economy and our country are much better off because American families have basically done whatever it took to make it work. Never so but I think it's fair to say that as you look across the country, the deck is still stacked in favor of those already at the top. And there's something wrong with that. There's something wrong when CEOs make 300 times more than the typical worker. There's something wrong when American workers keep getting more productive, as they have, and as I just saw a few minutes ago, is very possible because of education and skills training, but that productivity is not matched in their paychecks. And there's something wrong when hedge fund managers pay lower tax rates than nurses or the truckers that I saw on I-80 as I was driving here over the last 2 days. And there's something wrong when students and their families have to go deeply into debt to be able to get the education and skills they need in order to make the best of their own lives. And I looked at the figures. The average Iowa graduate from a four-year college comes out with nearly $30,000 in debt. And that's, I think, the ninth highest debt load in the country. And people are struggling. I met earlier today with a young student who is piecing together work and loans, knowing full well he's going to come out owing a lot of money. So we've got to figure out in our country how to get back on the right track. Business is the backbone of the American economy. Here in New Hampshire, 96% of all businesses are considered small businesses. And they employ more than half of the workers, the employees in the state of New Hampshire. So New Hampshire is a perfect example of what it takes to start and grow a small business. I come from a small business family. My father had a very small business. He printed drapery fabrics in a print plant, and he did much of the work himself, sometimes with day laborers, sometimes with my mother and my brothers and me, literally taking a squeegee for the paint on the silk screen. You take the squeegee, you go down, then you lift it up, and you go to the next, and you keep going. And I saw where now there's a machine that you just bought that's printing on all kinds of material.
So I think most folks, Republicans and Democrats, and whether you agree with Hillary Clinton or not, I think most folks aren't really in need of an explanation for why she's running. So where is this punditry coming from, the notion that she needs to explain why she's running?
I think I take too many. This one's the last for a while.
The only thing I could think of is what happened back in Campaign 80, when one of my CBS News favorites, correspondent Roger Mudd, asked Ted Kennedy why he was running for president. And Ted Kennedy didn't have an answer. I mean, he had a two-minute reply, but he didn't have an answer.
Couldn't tell for sure if it was really real.
Why do you want to be president?
I wash my hands.
Well, I'm...
Wash my head too.
Were I to make the announcement,
to run. The reasons that I would run is because I have a great belief in this country. For innovation in the world and the greatest political system in the world. And yet I see at the current time that most of the industrial nations of the world are exceeding us in terms of productivity, are doing better than us in terms of meeting the problems of inflation, that they're dealing with the problems of energy and their problems of unemployment. This nation can cope and deal with its problems in a way that it has in the past. We're facing complex issues and problems in this nation at this time, but we have faced similar challenges at other times. And the energies and the resourcefulness of this nation, I think, should be focused on these problems in a way that brings a sense of restoration in this country, by its people, in dealing with the problems that we face. Primarily the issues on the economy, the problems of inflation, and the problems of energy. And I would basically feel that that it's imperative for this country to either move forward, that it can't stand still, or otherwise it moves backward.
Walking through the door, we're burning halfway.
Many political folks and just plain voters at the time saw this as the moment Teddy's bid for the nomination against Jimmy Carter imploded. So maybe that's why some pundits now insist that Hillary Clinton has to answer the question. A footnote. Elizabeth Warren, who has essentially replaced Ted Kennedy as the leader of the progressive wing of the party in the Senate, is not running for president. But pundits keep asking her if she's going to run, no matter how many times she says no.
You didn't think you'd get away with this interview without me asking you point blank, are you going to run for president?
No. I'm not running, and I'm not going to run. You know, I'm in Washington. I've got this really great job and a chance to try to make a difference on things that really matter. I think we need to lower the interest rate on student loans. I think we need to put more money into medical research. I think that we need to raise the minimum wage. Nobody should work full-time and still live in poverty.
Now, but you know when this is over, I'll be looking for a way to let it go.
I think we need to strengthen Social Security and expand its reach. There's a lot to fight over right this minute.
Are you unequivocally and categorically saying, I'm not running for president in 2016?
I'm not running. You know, though, what I am doing is I'm out fighting for a set of issues.
That brings me back to how much Elizabeth Warren has had an impact on Campaign 16 without running. Have you noticed how everyone is now talking about helping the middle class, and not just Democrats? Of course, in the case of Republicans, what they mean by helping the middle class is more trickle-down economics, featuring tax breaks for the rich and slashing Social Security and Medicare to pay for those tax breaks for the rich.
I went to St. A's on Tuesday and gave a speech on entitlement reform.
There's a better life for me and you. One thing I know is true, yeah. You'll be dead before your time is due. Know it.
And the speech I gave on the time of reform is very simple and very direct. 71% of the federal budget is now spent on entitlements compared to 26% 50 years ago. Comes up on this stage and wants to talk to you about national defense, wants to talk to you about education, research and development, tax cuts, or anything else involving the federal government, you should ask them what they're going to do on entitlements.
Girl, it's a better life for me and you.
2.
Going to do something to fix that problem, we're not going to be able to deal with any of the other problems or opportunities that we have in this country. I'm used to this because when I got to New Jersey on a $29 billion budget, we had an $11 billion deficit. And my Democratic legislature sent me a tax increase, one of five they've sent me. Of all five, I vetoed, and we balanced that budget, an $11 billion deficit, by cutting 800 programs in New Jersey in order to balance that budget. There are ways that we can put our fiscal house in order in this country, and we need to. And everybody who is considering running for president of the United States should have to answer for you what they're going to do regarding the cost of entitlement programs in our country and how they're going to make it fairer for everybody, not just for one generation, but for all generations.
We've had trickle-down economics, the same trickle-down economics that took us to the brink of a depression in 2008 before President Obama took office. And they want to take us right back there again. In this short period of time, the first 100 days, they've already passed or marked up tax bills that will give tax breaks to the super wealthy and special interest up to about $600 billion and more to come. This isn't job creating, it is deficit increasing. This is the same trickle-down economics that has never worked, that they have proposed Republican president after Republican president and now congressional Republicans.
I can't remember a time when this early in the campaign, the candidates already had their stump speeches pretty well set. And the lines of argument are already repetitive to the point of annoying.
Monday is January, Friday is December. The calendar means nothing.
Can't imagine this is just the beginning of a long, long run-up to primary season before we even get to the general election. But here we are.
American business startups are down. Small business creation and expansion is down. But the figure that really caught my eye is a recent World Bank survey of the entire world, where now America ranks 46th in the world in how hard it is to start a new business. We have to be number one. Slowly over time, it's become more difficult, more expensive, more red tape, unnecessary regulations that has really put a damper. And then that was unfortunately exacerbated greatly by the effects of the Great Recession, where a lot of banks stopped lending. They stopped lending to small businesses. They stopped lending to people with good ideas. They stopped taking chances on real opportunities for Americans. And unfortunately,
you know,
we can see the results.
I was coming up, I was a little bit startled because I could have sworn I saw Hillary's Scooby-Doo van outside.
One day I'll be stronger, my
And then I realized it couldn't possibly be that. Because I'm pretty sure y'all don't have any foreign nations paying speakers, right? What an incredible gather. Testament. I mean, has this not been an incredible array of strong conservative leaders for two solid days? What a testament to the desire for Americans. We want something new. We want new leadership to change the page and to turn around. The Democratic version of this, I'm pretty sure, is Hillary Clinton having a conversation with a Chipotle clerk.
I don't want a coronation on our side by any stretch of the imagination.
I don't see any coronation coming my way.
Well, you know.
Sounding out the views of people around the country. I've been traveling around. I'm seriously considering the possibility of running, and over the next few months, I'll make a decision about that. But I'm honored to be here, to be able to talk to you a little bit about me.
Hello, I'm Dan Rather, and you're listening to What's the Frequency, Kenneth? With musical host Paul Fisher in New York City.
Kind of interesting. I'm looking out at this room, and I'm seeing these incredible pictures, some of which bring back really fond memories. Guy over there. So I know for a fact, if I go beyond the consideration, that I'm going to have to show my heart, show who I am, tell my story. It's a little different than the story of my brother and my dad. This may come as a shock to you, but you have brothers and sisters, so you may appreciate this. We're not all alike. We make our own mistakes in life. We are on our own life journey.
Of all the things that's gone on in the last 6 years, of all the scandals, and when I think of the scandals, I think of old McDonald's farm of scandals. Here a scandal, there a scandal, everywhere a scandal. I think of the scandals, the one that probably bothers me the most is Benghazi.
way, the controversy is we no longer fund Planned Parenthood in the state of Wisconsin. We
lost again.
Passed major pro-life legislation as well. We signed concealed carry and the Castle Doctrine that law-abiding citizens can have access to firearms to protect themselves and their family, their loved ones. We passed, and just about a month ago, the U.S. Supreme Court took action to allow us to once again uphold the law I signed to say that if you want to vote in the state of Wisconsin, you have to carry a photo ID to prove who you are. And earlier this year, I signed into law legislation that now makes it the case that Wisconsin's the 25th state in the country to have right to work, so you don't have to be a part of the labor union if you want to work in the state of Wisconsin.
This is an incredibly resilient country. We've lived through a civil war. We've lived through two world wars. We've lived through a Great Depression. We lived through Jimmy Carter. We'll live through Barack Obama.
Why is this happening? We're the greatest nation in human history. And the answer is because we have too many leaders that are trapped in the past.
Why did you adopt?
People who think it's still the 20th century.
So draining to hear the same old arguments, not just day after day, but the same old arguments every 4 years.
Feeling sick at the sight of his computer, he dodges his way.
That even when an important issue comes along, it's hard to stay focused. Case in point, the TPP. Another humongous international free trade deal like NAFTA. President Obama supports, including fast-track approval. And to muddy the issue even more, most Republicans support the TPP, while some Democrats and most unions oppose it.
Roberta Rampton of Reuters.
Thanks. President Obama, some congressional leaders yesterday came to a deal on fast-track for trade. But it's clear that many in your party are opposed, including Senator Schumer. And are you worried that your support for this is going to divide your party going into 2016? And will it hurt your party's ability to win? Do you need Hillary Clinton's support on this?
On trade. First of all, I want to congratulate Senators Wyden and Hatch for coming up with a bipartisan framework for trade promotion authority. And without getting into the weeds on it, I think it's important to recognize that the trade promotion authority is not the same as a trade agreement. It just gives us a structure whereby when a trade agreement is presented, it can move forward in a quicker fashion and not get completely bogged down in the usual procedures. Receiving the same trade promotion authority that every president in the post-war era, with the exception of Richard Nixon, has received. So it's not exceptional. What is exceptional is that in this framework, for the first time, there are requirements for enforceable labor environmental provisions. There is a clear attention to issues like human rights.
I think there's no enforcement. I was in Mexico last week with progressive groups, including independent unionists. They haven't been talked to at all. So this notion that somehow we will will it through words in a chapter, when the country's involved, whether it's Vietnam, where none of the challenging groups are involved, or whether it's Mexico, where the conditions for workers continue to get worse, it's impossible. And we've had no enforcement before. We get reports. I was in Honduras. We got a nice report on Honduras 3 years after the complaints were filed. Guatemala 6 years later. And then Mr. Froman meets with those governments. Corporations get the right to sue and get billions of dollars. So it's not any better. It's just better words in some ways, but the end result is exactly the same. Citizens get nothing.
And in many ways, this is the most far-reaching and progressive trade promotion authority that we've seen going through Congress. And that's important because, as I've said before, it is entirely understandable that there is some skepticism around trade. Working families who live in a town that saw manufacturing collapse and jobs being outsourced. People recognize that there have been circumstances in the past in which trade may have contributed to aggregate growth of the global economy or even the U.S. economy, but hurt workers. And we've learned lessons from that. And this Trade Promotion Authority, thanks to the work of Senator Wyden and Hatch, reflects some of those lessons.
I'd like to quote really a good friend of all of ours, and that was Governor Ann Richards, when she said, "You can put the lipstick and earrings on a pig, call it Monique, but it is still a pig." this agreement today, it really is what Fast Track was all about in 2014. And when it arrived in the Congress, it was dead on arrival, and it will be continued to be opposed in this Congress as well. We've got laid out negotiating objectives that are not enforceable in any way. You take a look at currency and... say that we should avoid currency manipulation. Think about that. Avoid. What does that mean? There is no prohibition. And indeed, this treaty has been in the making for 5 years, and we know, and we've been told that there will be no currency chapter in it. And currency is directly related to loss of job. Of wages, and the data is overwhelming, and they will not address it
now in terms
in this fast track bill.
Actually, getting a deal done, the first trade agreement that we potentially would present under this trade promotion authority would be the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. Spoken to this before, but I will just repeat that 95% of the world's markets are outside our borders. The fastest growing markets, the most populous markets, are going to be in Asia. And if we do not help to shape the rules so that our businesses and our workers can compete in those markets, then China will set up rules that advantage Chinese workers and Chinese businesses. And that will set the stage over the next 20, 30 years for us being locked out, us being unable to protect our businesses from discrimination, our agricultural products being excluded from these areas, high tariffs that prevent us from being able to compete fairly.
Which is the fast tracking. Andrew, when you think about it, we just went through a whole debate, and we're still going through the debate of Iran. Should we be involved, this Congress? I think 100 members want to be involved in this tremendous decision as far as on foreign policies. Don't you want to be involved in this absolute largest trade deal ever contemplated? And I'm not going to subrogate and basically allow someone else to do that for me when I would like to have some input. Now, about TPP, I think if we all set and work together, we can get something that's
good for
the working
people. When it comes to services, or it comes to the internet, for example, our ability to maintain intellectual property protection or freedom in the internet or other requirements that tilt the playing field against U.S. workers. That's what's going to happen. So what we are doing is negotiating the highest level, highest standard trade agreement in our history with strong enforceable
in, but we have no process. We have no put-in, if you will, from the Congress. This is pretty much going to be negotiated. All we can do is vote it up or down, but really vote it down. Can't even vote it up. So I want to be involved. If I wanted to be involved in Iran, which I thought I should. On the Menendez Kirk said if they don't have a deal by June 30th, then we would double down with sanctions. I want to be involved in this. And I'm not for TPA. I'm still debating whether I can be for TPP or not.
And
which is the
I will be
deal,
able to
like
show
to have some input on that
when
deal.
The final agreement is presented. This is absolutely good for not just American businesses, but for American workers. And it's good for our economy. It's the right thing to do. Now. Last point I'll make on this, the politics around trade has always been tough, particularly in the Democratic Party, because people have memories of outsourcing and job loss. The point I've made to my labor friends and my progressive friends is that companies that are looking for just low-cost labor, they've already left. We're already at a disadvantage right now. And the trade agreement I'm proposing would actually strengthen our ability to force other markets open and strengthen our position compared to where we are right now. To this new trade agreement is essentially a ratification of the status quo where a lot of folks are selling here, but we're not selling there. Japan is one of the negotiators in this deal. Now, last time I checked, if you drive around Washington, there are a whole bunch of Japanese cars. You go to Tokyo and count how many Chryslers and GM and Ford cars there are. So the current situation is not working for us. And I don't know why it is that folks would be opposed to us opening up the Japanese market more for U.S. autos or U.S. beef. Doesn't make any sense. So I'm going to be able to make a strong case, but I think it's important when you talk about dividing the party. Okay, we got a Korean free trade agreement passed, we got a Colombian free trade agreement passed, and Panama free trade agreement passed over the last several years during my presidency. It didn't divide the Democratic Party. There's going to be a set of Democratic senators and House members who traditionally have just on principle opposed trade because the unions on principle, regardless of what the provisions are opposed to trade.
And then there are the others who, like me, believe that we cannot stop a global economy at our shores. We've got to be in there and compete. And we've got to make sure we're writing the rules so that we've got a level playing field, because when we do, products made in America, services provided by American firms are the best in the world.
They were mine, they were ours. I was caught in your arms. There's nothing like
I will continue to make that argument. And for those who argue that somehow this is contrary to the interests of working families, what I tell them is,
there's nothing like this.
My whole presidency has been about helping working families and lifting up wages and giving workers more opportunity. And if I didn't think this deal was doing it, I wouldn't do it. I didn't get elected because of the sponsorship of the Business Roundtable or the Chamber of Commerce. Those aren't the ones who brought me to the dance.
I make the same mistakes. I remember the day that you said.
I'm doing is because I know this is an important thing to do, and I also know that it sends a signal throughout Asia that we are out there competing and that we are going to help maintain international rules that are fair for everybody and not so tilted in favor of one country. It ends up being bad for not only our commercial prospects, but for other countries over the long term. That was a very long answer.
Do you have any concerns about the trade deals and whether that will hurt?
Well, any trade deal has to produce jobs and raise wages and increase prosperity and protect our security. And we have to do our part in making sure we have the capabilities and the skills to be competitive. So it's got to be really a partnership between our business, our government, our workforce, the intellectual property that comes out of our universities. And we have to get back to a much more focused effort, in my opinion, to try to produce those capacities here at home so that we can be competitive in a global economy.
And on What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Campaign 16. Granite and Barrett. The candidates come to New Hampshire. For the complete playlist of music and sound bites on the program, go to the program's Facebook page. What's the Frequency, Paul? For now, here's the short list of music I played. Started off with Strange Days by The Doors. Wave of History by Downtown Boys. Teeth by The Japanese House. Father Clock World by The Vogues. Dark World by Speedy Ortiz. Sam Furman did Philosopher. We Gotta Get Out of This Place by The Animals. Before the World Was Big by Girlpool. Painted by Ms. Mister. Waxahachie did Gray Hair. Toupee did Sensei Swami Guru. We heard Abnormal Restriction by Jay Lynn.
Elevator Operator by Courtney Barnett. Hopalong did Waitress. Hill did TV Wedding. 07 did Crush Day. We heard Todd by Couche. Nothing Like This by The Leisure Society. And in the background now, that's Sick Day, Fountains of Women. And you've been listening to What's the Frequency, Kenneth? I'm Paul Fisher.
John's is a different butcher's. Next place you are uptown, pay him a visit. Or, better still, come to buy. You will enjoy cattleman's spring meat. John's is now quite divorced from baking. Fattens, kills, flays, hangs, draws, quarters, and pieces. Feel his lambs, X. Feel how sheep, XX. His liver, too, is great value. A speciality. XXX. Communicated.
As I please. Saturday mornings at 6 on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
The 2015 Public Service Champions of Change Forum will take place on Thursday, April 30th at 7 p.m. You will meet financial reform guru Barney Frank, co-author of the Dodd-Frank Bill, and other experts on climate sustainability, income equality, healthcare reform, and civil rights, on the role of the true public servant. This special event is sponsored by WBAI supporter, the New York Society for Ethical Culture. For ticket information, go to nysec.org. That's the 2015 Public Service Champion of Change Forum, April 30th, 7 p.m. For information, go to nysec.org.
This is Phil Donahue, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5. Good morning. Welcome to WBAI, the morning show, 99.5 FM. I'm Jed Brand in the studio today with Tony. How you doing, sir?
Oops, I'm doing pretty good.
Well, Michael G. Haskins is under the weather today.
Very under the weather. I spoke to him yesterday, and he sounds terrible.
Well.
So we heard it happening during the week, and we were hoping that he would recover, but it's pretty bad for him. So I send out my prayers, and I hope you, as the BAI family, send out their prayers for his recovery.
Yes. Michael never sounds terrible.
Okay, well, he sounded terrible. I'm sorry.
Okay, we can't lie, but we'll try to sound all right. We have a great show coming up today, which Michael helped set up. At 6:30, we're going to be talking on the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. We have a special guest, Anoush Ter Taulian. She's an activist and producer, and she's preparing a one-hour radio special for WBAI, which will air this Friday at 5 p.m. And we'll be discussing some of the current issues around that with Anoush. Coming up after that, Jarrett Murphy, the editor-in-chief of City Limits, we'll be discussing his piece on de Blasio's sweeping vision for the city. Mayor de Blasio issued a major Earth Day address and came out with what we call a bold vision for the city in 2030. And we'll be talking some about that, which I definitely look forward to. City's been under a lot of transformation in this century, and we'll see what they're projecting for the future. Coming up in the 7 o'clock hour, we will be talking about the New York Public Library. We have a segment that was produced by Jillian Jonas, and several news reports reveal that New York City's public libraries are in dire straits. The conditions are dismal, they say. Funding is below pre-recession levels, and the system ranks low for the number of hours branches are open. For all the fans out there of the New York Public Library, Brooklyn Library System, we'll be talking with David Giles. He is a research director for the Center for an Urban Future, and also Christopher Pratt, who is a vice president of library services at the New York Public Library. And that will be happening in the 7 o'clock hour. But first, we'll be switching to Linda Perry with the news for today, Thursday, April 23rd.
Good morning. In honor of Earth Day and Earth Week, the de Blasio administration unveiled an ambitious new plan. It's called One NYC, the plan for a strong and just city. One NYC initiatives include reducing the city's greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050 and sending zero waste to landfills by 2030. Also ensuring that New York City has the best air quality among all cities in the U.S. by 2030.
Look. I don't blame anyone who's cynical. I represent 8.5 million jaded people. I go around the city trying to find the wide-eyed optimist. I haven't found them yet.
Plan NYC contains over 200 initiatives to improve the city. It builds on former Mayor Mike Bloomberg's Plan NYC for Sustainability, but it adds updates and an economic equality component. At the center of the mayor's vision is addressing both sustainability and economic inequality. The plan aims to bring 800,000 people out of poverty over the next 10 years.
We're committed to reaching that goal. And it's as simple as this. You cannot have a successful city if more and more people are falling behind. You cannot have a successful city if people feel they don't have an economic future. Just as Plan NYC literally asked the question, what would a successful city look like in the future in terms of sustainability, resiliency, economic growth? We ask all those questions, but one more. What will a city look like in the future in terms of economic inclusion? And if there isn't growing economic inclusion, how can that city be strong? How can it be successful? How can it be a global leader? How can it compete in an ever more globalized world?
New York City is a city of hard surfaces, of right angles. The outdoors here is a lot like the indoors. It's under control. It's often shiny and a little grimy, too.
Nilda Mesa is director of the city's Office of Sustainability. She says we can't control the outdoors in the city.
Grass creeps between sidewalk cracks. Red-tailed hawks roost on the shoulders of the apostles in the niches of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, while owls and herons live in our parks, along with the occasional coyote. And our children have asthma from dirty air. Our seniors suffer during heat waves. Our neighborhoods flood.
But there are things which can be done to improve the city, according to the director of sustainability. She stands at Hunts Point in the Bronx. That's where they are going to capture methane, the gas that forms from the decomposition of organic materials. They'll turn it into a source of clean energy. And some of what can be done on Earth Week and throughout the year is simple. Donovan Richards, chair of the City Council's Environmental Committee, points out how wasteful we've become as New Yorkers. He says New York City's recycling rate can be much better. He points out that thousands of buildings across the city burn their lights all night long, wastefully. Turn them off, says Richards.
We must learn to become more efficient and use our resources wisely. And today's plan puts us on a path of net zero waste and doing something that won't cost this city any money. That is just simply turning off the lights when we aren't using them. And my father was so cheap that he used to make us unplug the clock at night because he said you can't tell time in your sleep. It's a Chris Rock joke, actually, but it is true. He did turn off the heat, though. I do want to say that. I leave you all with a quote. Yeah, because he said you don't know if you're hot or cold when you sleep. That's unbelievable. But I leave you all with a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on this Earth Day. It really boils down to this, that all life is interrelated. We are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality.
Included in One NYC are plans for ensuring that neighborhoods are resilient, that public services are ready to withstand the impacts of climate change. The mayor says whether the plan works is dependent on the people of the city.
Changing people's minds, making the people a partner in this process, is how you really move forward. So this plan depends on the people. It depends on the people to demand some of the changes we need and to sustain this vision. It's going to go on not just into the administration that follows mine, but many more thereafter. But I think if the people believe, if it becomes a consensus in the city, it will have the support it needs.
For more information on the initiatives, go to nyc.gov/onenyc. That's O-N-E-N-Y-C. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
And welcome back. I'm Jed Brandt, joined in studio with Tony Ryan on the board, standing in for Michael G. Haskins. Well, I got the call last night to come in, and I was thinking through having this chance to come on the air. Maybe one of the biggest things that happened in the last week that hasn't been widely discussed here in the U.S. was the passing away of Eduardo Galeano, truly one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. In Latin America. He comes out of Uruguay. And if listeners aren't familiar, he may be best known in recent times. There was an incident where Chavez gave the U.S. president a copy of Open Veins of Latin America, which was a scathing indictment of the U.S. traditional role in Latin America. But it's perhaps Galeano's fiction writing. He started with journalism. But he moved towards a sort of poetic novel form. And he wrote a trilogy called The Memory of Fire, which is really a remarkable achievement. If it had been written centered in North America, it might just be called The Great American Novel. But it's far more expansive than that. It takes us to that place where America is not just the 50 states here that had the founding fathers and all that, but every wellspring, all the headwaters that gave rise to this great thing we call the Americas, north and south, from Argentina up to Alaska. And the first book is called Creation, and it begins with a series of, I guess, anecdotes and creation myths that take us through the 500-year period where this combination of Europe and Africa and the indigenous people of the Americas came to produce this what we call New World. And I guess I was going to read just the opening anecdote. Can we indulge that, Tony?
Sure, go ahead.
When was the last time somebody read a creation myth in a poem on the air here?
On the air? I think we're about to hear one, aren't we?
We're about to hear one.
At 11 a.m. on a Thursday morning, April 23rd, 42 degrees.
I think that's a great way to start.
I just want to keep a record. I mean, how long is this? No profanity, is it?
No profanity. It's called The Creation. And it says, I'll just read it now.
Go.
The woman and the man dreamed that God was dreaming about them. God was singing and clacking his maracas as he dreamed his dream in a cloud of tobacco smoke, feeling happy but shaken by doubt and mystery. The Indians know that if God dreams about eating, he gives fertility and food. If God dreams about life, he is born and gives birth. In their dream, about God's dream, the woman and the man were inside a great shining egg, singing and dancing and kicking up a fuss because they were crazy to be born. In God's dream, happiness was stronger than doubt and mystery. So dreaming, God created them with a song. He sang, I break this egg, and the woman is born, and the man is born, and together they will live and die. But they will be born again. They will be born again and die again and be born again. They will never stop being born because death is a lie. And I think that opening for a history of the entire Americas is a wonderful epitaph for a writer like Eduardo Galeano, who gave us so very much. And if I have an extra 10 minutes here on the air to just make a mention, I want to encourage everyone out there to pick up The Memory of Fire by Eduardo Galeano and treat themselves. If you have kids, I think this is a great place to start with knowing who we are in history. And sometimes when great people pass away, we have a tendency to mourn. you know, just to feel bad and say, oh, they're gone. That's not happening anymore. But I think that the great gift that an artist gives is they help us see that world even after they've passed on. In that sense, death is truly a lie. Death is truly a lie.
Is that available where? All bookstores?
Well, it's available at the New York Public Library. And we will be talking later with some folks from the library. We got to use it or lose it. The library is just like WBAI.
I'll start off by saying I'm happy that you mentioned that about the library, because I am such a major fan of the library. A library in my town where I live in New Jersey, and the library we have is so beautiful. I mean, it's so accessible as far as obviously the library itself, but with the items that they have in there. They have state-of-the-art computers. They have conference rooms. I was just talking about that with a friend of mine, and she wanted to give classes on I forgot what the field is at the moment, but she wanted to give class. I said, well, you should go to the library. It's free, and they offer you their conference rooms, and you can do. And they have projections, and you can use all type of state of the art equipment.
Which town are you in Jersey?
I live in Rahway, New Jersey.
And they've got good libraries out there now.
Yeah, excellent libraries. So it's there. I don't think a lot of people realize this is my little soapbox about libraries, but libraries are so up to date now. And so you can go there. And the reason why I told her about the library or the conference rooms is because, okay, suppose you get stuck on something. Well, the library's right there. You're in a library. You just go and find whatever it is that you're looking for, come back in 5 minutes, and then you can educate your people. You can literally get your master's degree in the library. Just because, in the sense of taking, you know, if you took online courses, you can sit right there and just educate yourself and become.
When I dropped out of high school, the first thing my father said was, well, if you're not going to be in school, you better have a job and go get a library card.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And it's the truth. Taking a book series like the Memory of Fire, the trilogy, that almost itself contains a library. Just
right.
This one series of books. And there's a way, I think, that we've become so accustomed to factoids and information and just sort of knee-jerk reflections on how we feel about the events of the day, like a superficial glance. And there's something about not just reading or studying individually, but actually making use of these democratic institutions.
Right.
Like people are talking about the post office and how the post office is always having problems. These are manufactured problems, right? If we try to think about what a post office would be in the 21st century...
Mm-hmm.
Right, it's not just going to be a place where you send a letter.
Right,
it's going to be the internet.
Right,
right. And it was a funny thing where the internet's under the control of the FCC, not under library authorities.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and there's a similar way that the postage is what allows us to communicate without
right.
everything being a direct financial transaction.
Right.
Once upon a time, it was free to send publications through the U.S. Postal Service. Right, people don't remember this.
Yeah, that's a while.
Now they say, well, if you want to do that, you can't do that anymore. It costs right. you $1 to send a publication.
Right.
Right. And so it ends up making it so that the only people who can afford to use it are junk mail marketers. Right. And then the whole thing becomes overwhelmed with garbage and doesn't become useful, and communications takes place electronically.
Right.
The library, exactly what you were saying, up to date. It's one thing to have a whole series of books to be able to get into the history of literature and languages and the arts and whatnot. But it's actually the fact that we do that together and in common, that we create a kind of social commons.
Right.
And that thing cannot just be reproduced by a Facebook group. which reminds me,
yes.
The WBAI Morning Show now has a Facebook group up on online. And we will be loading up segments there after the shows. So people can check back on particular interviews. And I would encourage everyone to go and like that and to follow that.
Well, give the actual URL.
The actual URL is when you get onto Facebook, search for WBAI Morning Show. And it should be facebook.com/WBAI Morning Show. Mm-hmm. But I think people should be able to find it easy enough. And it's also another way.
So basically you're saying that you're archiving your stuff up there?
We're also using it as a form of communication.
Right.
Right. So people can reach the different producers of the morning show, give feedback and criticism.
In real time.
In real time. And over the next few weeks, we'll be rolling out a social media development. Right. So we'll be trying to develop additional web presences, and particularly having a Twitter profile, which we will integrate into our online, into our actual live discussions. Mm-hmm. And the traditional means of just doing the random phone call in, that's that can go anyway, as we know.
Yes.
But I think developing out the social media will create a much more communicative aspect and will really help listeners cue us up to the stories that are happening in your community. And WBAI is the radio station of this community, and we are proud to serve.
You know, sometimes I feel like that gets lost in the translations of, as far as translations being the producers and even the community itself. They forget that that we're a community radio station, even though we do, for whatever reasons, we do foreign affairs. We tend to do things outside of United States as well as current events here, but we tend to sometimes forget the local aspect of this radio station, and we need more, I guess, listeners becoming involved with the radio station in the sense of, you know, letting us know about, you know, whatever events might happen throughout the city, calling us when something, they might have seen something in negative that they might not agree with. Of course, we always have this new issue with the police, not maybe new, but, you know, but the whole, I was just looking at the news just a little while ago. There was a police shooting in Queens. A man got shot, mm-hmm. and by the police. They mm-hmm. claimed that he was armed. And so mm-hmm. we'll see how that's going to develop, because, you know, where the microscope is now on them so far. And, you know, we tend to, like I said, drift away from the community aspect of the radio station. Well, we're still local. No matter what we talk about and whatever issues, we still should be talking about your day-to-day, you know, life, getting up in the morning till you go to bed at night, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We still need that. We still need your support.
Well, speaking of community...
And vice versa, actually. We need to support the community more.
Well, that question of who we are is the governing question of the rest of our lives.
Exactly.
And I don't just mean the radio station here. I don't just mm-hmm. mean our residential communities. Figuring out who we are in the world seems like the time it is.
Right.
Because a lot of our institutions have been running on autopilot. And again, I don't just mean the most local ones. I mean the federal government. I mean the whole world economic system. A lot of this stuff's mm-hmm. been on autopilot for years. But tonight, Thursday, April 23rd, there will be a special show at B.B. King Blues Club and Grill, which is to bring Mumia home. Speaking of our community, mm-hmm. We've broadcast Mumia's commentaries many times. Our brother is still in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and has been having some serious health problems for the last few weeks. And we want to make sure that he's getting the medical care that he needs. And several performers, including M1 of Dead Prez, Tef Poe, Rebel Diaz, YC the Cynic, AJA Monet, Tanya Asila, King Capo, and Ramya Ramana will be performing. And that's going to be $15 at the door or $10
in price. Can't say the price.
I can't say the price. Yeah. It's going
late,
to be a benefit.
Yes, exactly. You can't really say it's a benefit.
I won't say the price, yes, but exactly. Bring your money. And it'll be at 7 p.m. The doors will open. It'll be an 8 p.m. show. So we hope to see you there. And that's going to be at B.B. King Blues Club and Grill. Bring Mumia home at 237 West 42nd Street tonight. And now we're going to hear a quick track from... My favorite album of the new century.
Yeah, that's why I needed to put in there.
Not play it enough. Every chance we get to put D'Angelo on the air, we're going to take it. Ain't that easy. Right. D'Angelo and the Vanguard, Black Messiah.
Smoke from me as you dream inside.
Back. I'm Jed Brandt on the air today with Tony Ryan on the boards. We will be joined shortly. We will be joined shortly by Anoush Ter Taulian. She's an activist and producer who has prepared a one-hour radio special on the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide that will air tomorrow, Friday, April 24th at 5 p.m. And on this anniversary of what was one of the first great genocides of the 20th century. It is still a burning controversy. There are still active efforts by the Turkish government to deny that any such thing occurred. And this comes up in foreign policy on a regular basis. So discussing this is, strangely enough, hard to do. Hard to do. So we're very thankful that Anoush can join us. And are you on the air now?
Yes, I am.
Good morning, Anoush.
Good morning.
So give us an idea of what we can look forward to on the special you're doing tomorrow at 5 p.m.
Well, tomorrow is April 24th, which is a worldwide commemoration of the Armenian Genocide in which the Turks killed 1.5 million Armenians and stole 90% of our homeland. There is going to be a march for justice from St. Vartan's and St. Illuminar's to the Turkish consulate, where we are going to demand that they pay reparations, return our land, acknowledge this genocide. It is outrageous that they continually distort history, and the United States does not recognize this genocide because they are allies of Turkey because of NATO bases to send arms to American soldiers that are killing people in various Middle Eastern countries. And Israel denies this genocide, but you know, they have even in the past paid, Jewish lobbyist groups have paid to have American Congress people deny this genocide. And we have this year, Amal Clooney, the wife of George Clooney, who's a human rights lawyer, is going to represent us in the European court because there's a court case where Switzerland had a law that it was a crime to deny the Armenian genocide, and then the Turk challenged this law. So she's going to be representing us. And I want everyone to, you know, Dr. Oz is Turkish, and I want everyone to go on his website and ask him to do a show, what are the detrimental health effects of denying the Armenian genocide, because this is the most extreme case of racism. They wanted to wipe out the entire Armenian nation, and what are the intergenerational traumas of this mental disease of racism. I know my own grandmother was taken as a sex slave in a Turkish harem. And, you know, Armenians, there were slave auctions. The women were comfort women. They had a lot of unresolved pain because it's an open wound, because the Turks are unpunished criminals and murderers and thieves. And it's very hard. There are socially conscious Armenians. Nora Amani has a socially relevant film festival right here in New York. Eric Bogosian, who's an actor, wrote a book about Project Nemesis, the trial of Solomon Chalabian, who had killed Talat Pasha, who was one of the organizers of the genocide. And the thing is that right now in Syria, ISIS, which continues this kind of mad Islamic extreme violence to, you know, turn people into Muslims. You know, they have destroyed Armenian communities in Syria, in Iraq. And I'm asking all Muslims and Christians and Jews on this weekend to whatever worship place they have, to have a minute of silence and a prayer to remember our martyrs. And, you know, there were you know, good Turks during this genocide. They had forced all these Armenian boys into this Turkish orphanage where they circumcised them and changed their names. And when the Turks lost the war, they ordered the pharmacist to poison all the orphans, but he refused and was killed. And there was also Germans involved in this genocide. And, you know, they had forced Armenians to carry heavy stones to build a German railway, and many died. And they had also, you know, were there. Actually, they helped plan this genocide because they had done the first genocide of the 20th century, the Hereros in Namibia, and pushed them into the Kalahari Desert.
Yes, which many people have not heard about at all.
Yes. And so then they gave the Turks the idea of pushing the Armenians into starvation death marches into the Syrian desert. And so the thing is that Turkey right now is using your taxpayers' money, American taxpayers' money. We give a lot of foreign aid to Turkey. In fact, I had made this banner, Armenia and Palestine Sisters in Struggle to Regain Their Occupied Homeland. And, you know, Turkey was getting $9 million a day in U.S. foreign aid, in Israel 13. And Turkey uses this money, some of it, to hire Turkish professors to distort history. So there's a really wonderful Armenian history specialist, Aram Arkun, and he can be reached at Arkuna, A-R-K-U-N-A, at earthlink.net, because whenever you want to check if the history facts are good, you can contact him. He also gives good lectures. And I just want to read you something from a survivor's testimony to get a sense of what was happening 100 years ago when they forcibly exiled. You know, they went around, they had a plan of each village. They had killed the, they sent the men out and killed them, and then the women and children and elderly were on deportation marches. So this is just a testimony from Sibyl Bulgarian. She says, the Turks killed and tortured my fathers and brothers and threw them over the bridge into the river to die. We were deported. They took away my five aunts to Deir Zor, later cut off their heads and impaled them with bayonets, showed them to us, and threw their corpses into the Euphrates. My mother wept so much that she lost her eyesight. The Turks had made a bonfire and were throwing Armenians into the flames. I and my sister began to shout and cry, but we could not rescue our mother from the fire. The Turks began slaughtering everyone in the village. They isolated two Armenian men and were skinning them alive. You cannot see the water because so many of the human corpses were turning the Euphrates red. And so what they did is, through terror, they just terrorized everyone. They would herd them into churches and burn them alive, and they would have the Armenians gather grass and make a bonfire and throw them into it. So, you know, we were defenseless people because they had taken away our arms. We were very peaceful people, agrarian people that, you know, were having orchards and great vineyards and beehives and everything. And the Turks just confiscated all of our property. If you go to Turkey, you have to realize that you are passing through the roads where they had the killing fields of Armenia. In Istanbul, you know, the Four Seasons Hotel was a Turkish prison, the one on the Bosphorus, where they would torture Armenians. They would cut out your tongue if you were speaking Armenian. You know, they would do terrible things. And so...
Anoush, I have a question. Here we are 100 years after these events.
Mm-hmm.
And why is the Turkish government today so invested in stopping discussion of what happened with Armenians at the very foundation of the Turkish
They have
Republic.
My grandmother's house. I want my grandmother's house. Everybody wants, they have our sacred Mount Ararat. You know, Mount Ararat is the symbol of Armenia. And it's under Turkish occupation. They're colonializing. Eastern Turkey is really occupied Western Armenia. And so the Turks even said that we shouldn't be using Mount Ararat, you know, as our symbol, because it's not on our land, it's on their land. And we said to them, well, you're using the moon on your flag and it's not on your land. So it's very painful. It's an open wound for us. And the reason why they're denying this genocide is because they would have to pay us reparations. They would have to return the land. They would have to admit how mentally deprived they were. I mean, they would do things like, how many babies could you kill on one sword? They would carry children up to their necks and run horses' hoofs over them. They were so cruel. They would slit open pregnant women's bellies and make a bed. Is it a boy or a girl? They would rape children in front of their parents and make a father, his dead relative. I mean, it's just to admit that they're like that, I guess, is very hard for me.
There's definitely been a range of discussion in Turkey and the world about this. There are laws in Turkey which also apply to Turks to stop them from discussing it.
Article 301, it's a crime to mention the Armenian genocide.
That law has been enforced against everyone from Turkish journalists and novelists. I believe Orhan Pamuk, the Nobel Prize winning novelist, historian of Istanbul, faced charges on these regards. Is it in any way related to the ongoing situation with Kurdish people in Anatolia?
Well, to tell you the truth, the Turks released the Kurds to viciously attack our caravans in the death march into the Syrian desert. And the Kurds killed a lot of Armenians, confiscated their property. They also raped a lot of women and took them as slave brides and kidnapped children and raised them as Kurdish. But the Kurds have apologized to Armenians because now they are being treated badly by the Turks. But the Kurds have not returned our property and the churches that we have on the lands that they stole. And also, you know, the Circassians and the Chetnians were involved in killing Armenians. And it wasn't only Armenians in this genocide. This was a Christian genocide. The Turks killed the Pontic Greeks and the Assyrians. So it's interesting that the Kurds did so many bad things and now they're in a position of being oppressed also.
History has a funny way of shifting that around. It's a funny way of shifting that around. Tell us again where the commemoration march will be happening.
Okay, the commemoration march is going to start from St. Vartan's Church. Like this is in New York City, 2nd Avenue and 31st. It's organized by the Armenian Revolutionary Federation and the Armenian Democratic Liberal Party. And we're going to march to the Turkish consulate and then have a candlelight vigil from 4 to 6 in front of the UN. Also, on Sunday, April 26th, there's going to be a procession from, again, St. Vartan's Church, and St. Illuminators is going to join it, which is also on the 27th and 2nd. And it will begin at 12 p.m., and then they're going to have a commemoration in Times Square that afternoon. And again, we ask people on this weekend, especially if you're Muslim and Jewish and Christian too, in whatever place of worship you have, please ask them for a minute of silence and a prayer for our martyrs, because this genocide is so hard to get into the media. It's just, you know, you don't see it covered that much in the newspapers. They never cover our April 24th commemorations, and so I'm so glad that WBAI does this.
Well, yeah, I mean, here in America, this country has still not come to grips with its original sins, I guess we would
say.
Right,
and it's so funny because Pope Francis acknowledged the Armenian genocide this year, and the president of Turkey withdrew the Turkish representative from the Vatican and said, you know, they were racist, and mentioned this, that, you know, well, what about your own crimes of killing the native people of America? And so while he's helping us, he's also not, you know, acknowledging his crimes. That's true. In the U.S., one of the reasons why they're not acknowledging the Armenian genocide is because they have the native genocide right here in America that is still going on, and we're on Lenape land in Manhattan. And, you know, I do a lot of solidarity work as an indigenous woman. I'm at the indigenous conference right now because the indigenous Bill of Rights, you know, everything in it applies to Armenians. We're not supposed to. We have the right to right of life, Article Number 7. We have the right not to be forced to assimilate. We have the right to transmit our language and oral traditions and our education. And right now, there's only 60,000 Armenians left in Turkey, and they're living under very oppressive situations. In every Armenian school, there's a Turkish vice principal, and anytime, you know, they say anything, they're watched and, you know, harassed, and it's still bad.
Yeah, it's been very, very intense. It's been very intense. And with the rise of ISIS just over the border, we are seeing some of these crimes continuing, in a sense.
Yes, I told you, they went into Syria and destroyed Armenian communities. And, you know, when Syria was bordering, Syria and Iraq were bordering Armenia at that time, and there's this big cave in